This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. The 21st century has already witnessed revolutions in Ukraine, Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya, alongside other uprisings and transformational movements that reach all over the world. But although these movements have their roots in earlier movements and revolutions, they are different from their predecessors. For one, these movements are increasingly nonviolent. And secondly, they're less ideologically driven. We have three experts with us. Leanda Vergara Camus is professor at the Department of Development Studies at the University of London. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Land and Freedom, the MST, the Zapatistas, and Peasant Alternatives to Neoliberalism. John Foran is professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of The Future of Revolutions, Rethinking Radical Change in an Age of Globalization, and Taking Power on the Origins of Revolutions in the Third World. Jack Goldstone is professor of public policy at George Mason University. He's the author of Revolution and Rebellion in the Early Modern World, Revolutions, a Very Short Introduction, and the co-editor of Political Demography, How Population Changes Are Reshaping International Security and National Politics. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We seem to be having a lot more revolutionary activity, and I wanted to understand the 21st century revolutions as opposed to the earlier revolutions. John Foran, you've identified something like 39 revolutions, and you've written about other kinds of mass transformations that have been occurring. I think you said there are three paths: revolution, autonomous spaces, and kind of via elections. How do we distinguish these, and what's different about them?
The 20th century was a very revolutionary period, particularly in what was known then as the Third World in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. And in the course of that century, there were maybe five or six sort of great revolutions, so-called social revolutions, which transform not only government, but the whole social structure and sometimes the economy. And revolutions, by definition, also require the participation of mass numbers of people to make them. So a revolution is a way of making history by a society. And in these revolutions, the five or six principal revolutions of the 20th century, maybe starting with the Mexican Revolution of 1910 to 1920, the Russian Revolution, which was not a Third World Revolution, but took place in 1917, the Chinese Revolution, which spanned several decades before Mao Zedong and the communists came to power in China in 1949. The Cuban Revolution under Fidel Castro, which took power on January 1st, 1959. And in the year of 1979, two revolutions, one in Iran, which overthrew the Shah, and another in Nicaragua, which overthrew the dictator Anastasio Somoza. What all of these revolutions had in common and what distinguishes them from most of what we see in the 21st century, similar efforts to really transform society, is that they were made usually by armed guerrilla movements. They were headed by usually a single charismatic figure like Mao Zedong or Fidel Castro or Villa and Zapata in the Mexican Revolution. And they were therefore organized sort of hierarchically with a chain of command. By organizing that way, they were able to overthrow seemingly powerful governments, well-armed and often supported by powerful outside allies. But what happened typically afterwards was that you had a kind of hierarchical narrowing of the political system rather than a kind of general participation by the people, because they'd come to power through these hierarchical entities. In the 21st century, we're seeing not yet a so-called grand social revolution, but we're seeing a number of very interesting what I would call movements for radical social change, which look very different. They are, by and large, nonviolent in their character. They are organized typically, as they say, more horizontally, more democratically, without always identifiable leaders. And they're advocating a new kind of society in a way that's a bit difficult to define in the 21st century. So I think that the nature of what used to be called revolution has changed, and I think that's a good thing. I think that the prospects for deep social change in this century, which I believe is necessary, are better because of the way that these movements have organized themselves. They have yet to succeed, but I think their prospects, should they ever do succeed, bode well for having a more kind of democratic and egalitarian outcome.
What do you attribute the change in strategy to, since you say we're by and large nonviolent now?
That's a good and hard question. These movements have made these decisions. And I think the first one to point to is the Zapatista uprising in southern Mexico, which took place in 1994. And they were an armed insurrection, but they very quickly became essentially a nonviolent force that concentrated on improving conditions in the very poor southern state of Chiapas. There's a kind of poetry to some of these movements, that is, the language and the sort of style and culture of these revolutions, I think, is simply a different kind of political culture that is more democratic, therefore, in a sense, less inclined to use violence, but nonetheless extremely radical and far-reaching in its vision for transforming societies.
Leandro Vergara Camus, I want to bring you in because he mentioned the Zapatistas. That's your area of studies. Do you see this the same way?
Yes, I think he's right. And it has to do, I think, a little bit at least with the ability of movement to learn. And the Zapatista movement learned from the guerrilla movements in Central America. And they learned that the use of violence brings attention, but it also brings more repression. So the Zapatista rose up in arm to bring attention to their struggles, to the centuries and decades of exploitation and marginalization. But they also knew that arms were not the path for radical social change. So the idea of the Zapatista was much more to bring awareness, but also generate some kind of movement towards autonomy within civil society in Mexico, even autonomy within civil society globally, and in order to deepen democracy and widen democracy. So not only understanding democracy in the sense of elections and political power, but also in terms of social justice, right to land, etc. So I think movements today in the 20th century are learning from what worked in the past and what needs to change.
One question about these movements for autonomy. I have a sense that I know what that means, but if you were going to look at it on the ground and describe it to somebody, what exactly does it look like?
Well, autonomy means the ability to decide on one's own life and one's own future. And it means the ability to not depend on either the state or the market for subsistence and for progress. So autonomy refers also to the ability of communities to find within themselves the resources and the strategies to go ahead.
Jack Goldstone.
I think there are some other things that we should note have changed. The societies in which those 20th century guerrilla revolutions occurred were mainly young, rural societies. And even if the revolution began in the capital city, the big task of revolutionaries was to take control of the countryside. And they had to defeat the existing state army. And both of those purposes required the revolutionaries to raise their own military force. The option of proceeding differently didn't really present itself as much as it does today. Today, governments are much more in the glare of international media, and so many, not all, I'll come to Syria in a minute, but many states are reluctant to unleash overwhelming force against their own people. And so what revolutionaries and movement leaders have discovered is that if they can occupy a public space and be firm and peaceful, then they can discourage the military and the government from attacking them. And if they stick to the nonviolence and stick to the occupation of space, they can often persuade the military to start to defect, and the government that opposes them backs down or in some cases runs away, as with Ben Ali in Tunisia or Yanukovych in Ukraine. So you have societies that are more sophisticated, better able to use media, facing governments that are usually more reluctant to unleash all the power of force. But as I say, they're exceptions. In Syria, what started out as a nonviolent resistance against the Assad regime was met with overwhelming force, and they had to turn to arms to defend themselves, and they continue to face a brutal life and death civil war. unfortunately, regimes that are willing to impose that kind of terror and damage on their own populations are much fewer today than in the past.
Although Libya, too, started out as a nonviolent protest, ended up in a violent conflict, but of course ended quite differently than Syria has so far.
You're quite correct, and it probably would have ended up in similar fashion to Syria if NATO had not intervened to disarm much of the heavy artillery and tank force that was being brought into position by Gaddafi. That did become a violent war, and unfortunately Libya is still racked by violence because the militias that were mobilized for that conflict have not gone away. I think that's one of the contrasts we see. Revolutions that start violently tend to stay violent for some time, whereas those that are able to change governments more peacefully are able to proceed to the tasks of putting together constitutions and building civil authorities without that kind of vicious conflict.
You have also written about the more current in our rearview mirror of yesterday, Ukraine, and also Thailand and Venezuela and Bosnia. You've said something like this is kind of a new wave of revolutionary movements.
I think that's right. They are new in the sense that John Foran mentioned. They are typically nonviolent. They're also taking place in much more advanced societies, both economically and politically, than the agrarian dictatorships that were overthrown in 20th century revolutions. These countries have started to make progress toward democracy. They have developed substantial urban middle classes. They tend to have pretty active media. And what we're seeing in this case is not so much people rising up against sheer poverty and oppression, as much as you're seeing the middle class and students taking the lead in demanding that their governments be more accountable, less corrupt, more constructive in meeting the needs of the people. I think these new movements, as John Foran said, are interesting partly because they don't have usually a kind of charismatic leader who's out to take control of society. They're rising up from a kind of diffuse middle-class feeling that this government is doing us wrong. It's working for its own benefit and not ours, and we shouldn't have to tolerate that anymore at this point in the 21st century.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about 21st century revolutions as opposed to the earlier revolutions. It seems to me, from what you've all said, that there are two forces of globalization going on at the same time that are contributing to this. One is, of course, we've got sort of the neoliberal economics that seems to be contrary to what some people actually desire for their everyday lives. But the second force is the role of how information is spreading and becoming a form of education for people if they do want to organize. John Foran?
What's new in the 21st century is that we're in the age of globalization. We're living in a global economy in which many argue that nation states don't have the power that they used to have. The global economy certainly is run by a relatively small number of very powerful corporations and banks and so forth. And there is a new type of revolution, if you will, that takes that into account and isn't aimed necessarily at a national state or taking power in a single country. And again, the Zapatistas, as Leandro mentioned, they inspired what became known as the global justice movement around the world, sort of linking young activists who thought that the problem was corporations and the problem was also the lack of democracy that existed because corporations could influence governments and elections so easily. And sort of the high watermark of the global justice movement was the 1999 shutdown of the World Trade Organization in Seattle by several thousand demonstrators who came from all points and sat down and engaged in acts of civil disobedience and blocked streets and prevented delegates from entering to negotiate the World Trade Organization's agenda, which was precisely to set the rules to make markets freer to this neoliberal economy that you alluded to. The other global movement, I think, that the one to watch and the one that I pay the most attention to and actually participate in myself now is known as the global climate justice movement. And that takes the ultimate, I think, global problem as its target, and that's, of course, the inexorable rise of climate change. And so this is very much a kind of networked, loose association of many groups across the world, and they do use the new social media that you raised in your question, and they use it to good effect.
So there seems to be simultaneous organizations and some that cross paths. And it's interesting in the age of decline in journalism with this rise of new media. Simultaneously, of course, we've got some countries, Turkey being the latest, that are trying to ban the use of social media like Twitter. How do you see this, Jack Goldstone?
This is really a futile effort and simply indicates how really frightened of open information for the public that leaders like Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan are. Now, in Egypt, there had been a lot of talk about social media being crucial, and certainly the initial organizers of the April 6th movement were very smart and managed to reach out to a few thousand people using social media. But the demonstrations were joined by people from all walks of life who communicated partly by telephone, by conversation, cell phone, seeing what was going on in the street. And when President Mubarak got alarmed and shut down social media, people left their computer screens, which had become uninteresting, and went out into the street in Tahrir Square because that's where the interesting buzz was happening. So in a sense, I think this is attacking the symptoms. People are anxious to communicate. They're anxious to share ideas. They'll do it by Twitter. They'll do it by Facebook. But they'll also do it by cell phone. Satellite and cable television has become a very big factor. It's hard to shut down all the TV stations, and people have found very clever ways of circumventing efforts to limit their access to internet, email, cell phones, and so on. Twitter, in fact, is broadcasting information on how to use SMS messaging to circumvent the curbs that Turkey has tried to put on Twitter. So I don't think you can stop people from reaching out to each other in this day and age, unless you really want to use military force to isolate them. There are just too many avenues and channels now, and people have learned how to be flexible and really creative in using them. They're building local communities, global communities that intersect across different kinds of boundaries, and that has made it much harder to suppress these kind of popular movements that have arisen in this century.
Leandra Vergara-Camus, let's bring you back in here. You've talked both about this sort of education and information age as well, and the Zapatistas, I think, were one of the first to use the internet to communicate with the world. I wanted to go to this information piece. One other aspect of your work looks at this sort of moving back and forth between non-capitalist relations within the organization, within the movement, but then having to go back out and have capitalist relations with the outside world. How does this all work?
Technology, I think, is a very important issue, but it's been, I would say, overblown, because the strength of the Zapatista is not in their use of technology. The strength of the Zapatista is that they've been able to bring together a variety of community that are isolated into one organization that has managed to politicize their members by distributing power within communities in discussion. The decisions are taken in assemblies. People that didn't have the right to voice in the rural communities in Mexico because they didn't have right to land were given political rights within Zapatista community. So they brought in people that had been disenfranchised from the political system in Mexico, but also from the rural community, the villages. So by bringing people in, by making them participate, you politicize them and you create a sense of community, you create a sense of an ability to change one's life, and you empower people. So mainly the strength of organization that I have studied, at least like the Zapatista or the MST, the strength is that they're able to control a territory or a space. Then they're able to politicize members of those communities through allowing them to participate in taking decision, in thinking about strategies, in learning how to confront power. At the same time that they're learning how to confront power, they're also learning how to take power, to take control. not only take control of the political process within their community, but also taking control of land and then being able to feed their families, being able to start producing. In the case, for example, of the MST, after a few years, they are able to start integrating the market. And very often, they, compared to other types of actors, because they control land, they're able to at least get around the market for one essential need that we all have, is to feed ourselves. So that gives them kind of margin of maneuver that other actors do not have. And it also allows this movement to be stronger. The technology is something that facilitates all that, but it's not the essential ingredient.
There are two things that I think you bring up here. One is that, first of all, the Zapatistas and the MST, the Brazilian landless movement, are among the poorest people who have organized. And yet that seems to be an anomaly if we look at Jack Goldstone's work. Mostly, it seems like the movements tend to be driven by the middle class. The second piece, which is something that I think John Foran has written about, is that it's not so much ideology driving as it may have been in the 20th century, but about everyday life. John Foran, that seems to be a prime difference between 20th and 21st century movements.
I would agree with that. My basic starting point for studying revolutions has been just that, that revolutions, in fact, are made certainly by people. People have to become active in large numbers to make a revolution, and you have to ask the question of how does that happen? And one of the most general ways in which that happens is people begin to elaborate a critique of the existing system, whether it be the lack of political freedom or whether it's their economic circumstances. And sometimes they do this in very sort of ordinary language. You know, they talk about bread, they want freedom, they want to govern themselves. And you don't really need an ideology. In the 20th century, most of the great social revolutions did have an ideology, and that was socialism. In the 21st century, they are much more loosely organized. I think that's, again, part of this whole constellation of things that make the 21st century different, that people are not going to necessarily agree on a single well-defined ideology is one point. And another is that people, I think, want to make their own sort of culture of resistance. And that varies widely, but it's found in every revolution.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about 21st century revolutions as opposed to the earlier revolutions. Jack Goldstone, what about this anomaly? You may not call it a revolution in this case because you've distinguished this out.
I think it's a mistake to try and fit all revolutions into a single pattern or box, even if you differentiate there's a 20th century pattern and a 21st century pattern, because these are creations of human beings, and so there'll always be exceptions and innovations. What you have in the cases you mentioned, the Zapatistas and the Brazilian land movement, they are movements of the poor, but they decided to be more peaceful and use media rather than guns to achieve their objectives. So they may have drawn on different groups, but they absorbed some of the lessons that other groups had followed in the same time. I mentioned Thailand as a place where the middle class is up in arms, and that's true in Bangkok. But it's also the case that poorer people in the northern part of the country have mobilized to defend what they see as their champion, Yingluck Shinawatra, the current prime minister. So what you see throughout the world is a variety of different contexts, a variety of different peoples. What we've seen in the last couple of years in Ukraine, in places like Kiev and in Bangkok, and now in Caracas and Venezuela, are movements in which the middle class is taking a leading role in demanding more genuinely democratic and accountable governments. But there are other places in the world where the poor or people who are facing ethnic discrimination or who have regions that have been treated badly are also mobilizing and absorbing some of the same lessons, using some of the same ideas and tactics and tools to pursue their goals.
If I can jump in, one thing also that needs to be taken into consideration when we think about revolution is that there's never a revolution that is made only by one class. all the revolution have always involved multi-class alliances. And one of the most important factor, I think, in any successful revolution is a split at the level of the ruling class. If there's no split at the level of the ruling class, there won't be a revolution. There needs to be some kind of split at the top so that the pressure that comes from below can change the situation.
Yeah, this is Jack Goldstone. I fully agree. It generally is the case that the bigger the change, the more the rulers need to be in a divided and vulnerable position, and the more you need really broad alliances between different groups in society trying to create change.
We had another scholar, Erica Chenoweth, on our program. She's done this study that looked at successful revolutions and found that the nonviolent ones are far more successful than the violent ones. Do you also find that to be the case?
This is John Corn. I tried to argue that in general, not in all cases, that is the way of the 21st century. And I would be remiss not to include in this conversation another path to power, which is simply for radical forces to come to power in an election, in a democratic election. And the now classic examples of this are the quite radical governments that have been elected in the last 15 years in Venezuela, in Ecuador, in Bolivia, that together with other Latin American countries are known as the Pink Tide. Pink because their radical political and economic projects, which are socialist or 21st century socialists, as they sometimes call them, are wedded with democracy. And again, a shift from 20th century taking of power by single parties. And I think this is also a sign of the 21st century because in Latin America, at least in the 20th century, it was very difficult for a party to the left of center to come to power. If it came to power, as in the case of Chile under Allende in 1970, it faced extreme external opposition from powerful actors like the United States and its own internal elite. And in the 21st century, it seems a lot harder to dislodge governments that have been democratically elected. They have simply got more legitimacy. Case in point being in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez won election after election. And when the military and the elite rose against him in a coup in 2002, they were unable to sustain that coup because people came out and opposed it. And also because his government was seen as legitimately elected by all their neighbors, the Organization of American States. Not a single country, except the United States, which is a member, supported that coup. And that sort of legitimacy that comes with that also, I think, saved him in that situation. But these are governments that come to power with a more or less radical agenda and try to legislate the changes, the social programs to benefit people that a revolutionary government might do. And I think they are a form of 21st century revolutions. They're democratic revolutions.
When we're talking about really more or less the global south, moving a little bit more to the left with these agendas, meanwhile, it seems like the global north or the first world, but including Australia and New Zealand, have really kind of electorally moved to the right. Is there any way to bridge these and try to understand what's going on globally, or is that too big of a question?
I don't think it's too big a question. I think it is the big question. And, you know, you put your finger on this very important trend that we're seeing growth in inequality around the world, and in the developed countries, it's being supported by governments who are committed to making the world an easier place for businesses to thrive, but are not as committed to making the world a place where ordinary workers and young people looking for their first job can thrive. Now, they're making that decision, I think, based on what they're told about the need to be competitive and to be business friendly and hoping it will work out. But we're certainly seeing a challenge to that notion, and the challenge is even stronger in developing countries where governments tend to be more corrupt. They're not just setting rules in favor of business, they're kind of breaking or discarding rules and leaving people really desperate to find a way to escape from a kind of top-down business and corruption that is hurting their chances to move forward. So I think we're going to see this become a global struggle in which the kind of emerging working and middle classes in the developing world may be leading the way in demanding governments that work to support their interests and not so much the interests of business leaders and elites.
Leandro Vergara Camus.
I think what we can see in these 30 years of neoliberalism is that neoliberal hegemony is much more stronger in the north than it is in the south. The left-wing parties in Italy, in France, in Germany, in the UK went really, really far away from what they were in the 70s and in the 60s. If you think of the Third Wave, for example, you wonder if it's really a party of the left. The union movement also has been hit very hard in these decades of neoliberalism in the north. So that has been the case also in the south, but in the south, movement have managed to reemerge. Some of them have moved away from political parties that were too on the right for them, and others have managed to create new parties, like in Bolivia and in Ecuador, for example. The indigenous movement was able to create their own political party that represented their own interests instead of aligning themselves with old left-wing parties that were also moving towards the center. So the political dynamics of the different regions are completely different. But this distinction, I think, between the strength of the neoliberal hegemony in the north versus in the south is an important difference.
Thank you to the three of you for joining us. It's been a great pleasure having you.
Thanks for the opportunity to join you tonight.
Thank you very much.
Leandro Vergara Camus is professor at the Department of Development Studies at the University of London. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Land and Freedom, the MST, the Zapatistas, and Peasant Alternatives to Neoliberalism. John Foran is professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of The Future of Revolutions, Rethinking Radical Change in an Age of Globalization, and Taking Power on the Origins of Revolutions in the Third World. Jack Goldstone is professor of public policy at George Mason University. He's the author of Revolution and Rebellion in the Early Modern World and Revolutions, A Very Short Introduction. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipper, Nankine Agassian, and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.